To welcome you all, but are especially delighted to welcome the River Valley School students. Would they please stand? Good. Thank you very much for coming. You may be seated. The students are here with a program called Court with Class. It's sponsored by the Supreme Court and the State Bar of Wisconsin. Students across the state are invited to come for an oral argument. If they accept the invitation, they are sent materials about the case that they will hear, and they may engage in some activities surrounding and relating to that case. And then they come, they listen to oral argument, and then a justice is assigned to speak with the students, and everybody is invited to attend. The discussion, and it takes place after our second case, will be around 12:15 or so. The discussion is centered on the procedures of the court in taking the case, deciding the case, not the substantive issues of the case that we're going to hear. So you're all invited. Is there anyone who would like a summary of the case we're about to hear? Because the marshal does have a summary. It's easier to understand the oral argument if you're familiar with the facts and the issues involved. If you'd raise your hand, we'll give you a summary. All right. Let me now introduce the court to all of you. On my far left is Justice Michael Gableman. He is the justice with whom you'll meet after our second case. Seated next to him is Justice Patience Robinson. To my immediate left is Justice Patrick Crooks. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. To my right is Justice Ann Walsh Bradley. To her right, Justice David Prosser, and on the far right, Justice Annette Ziegler. With those, one other thing I should tell you. At 11 o'clock, there will be a fire alarm testing. So the alarm will go off. You need not leave the building. This is the first Wednesday of the month testing. It's unpleasant, but everyone will survive, to put it positively. All right, I will call the first case, which is 08-AP-2812, Hocking versus City of Dodgeville. Arguing for Glenn Hocking is Christopher Stompout. 25 minutes and then 5 minutes in rebuttal, counsel. You may proceed.
It's the court, counsel. My name is Christopher Stomba, and my associate Tyler Keeler and I represent Glenn and Luann Hocking. I'll be arguing the merits of our case and the rebuttal. There are two primary issues before the court today. Both of these issues involve whether exceptions to the statute of repose apply, either one of which would permit this case, if applied, to go forward in the trial court. The first issue is, do consistent representations from the City of Dodgeville to Glenn Hocking that his water drainage issues would be addressed qualify as an exception under WSSTAT section 893.894B? So as to preclude application of the statute of repose. Second issue is, does the City of Dodgeville's negligence in the maintenance of a nuisance on property it owns within the subject subdivision qualify as an exception under WSSTAT section 893.894C? From 1977 until the mid-1990s, Glenn and Luann Hocking lived a peaceful life on a rural property just inside the city limits of Dodgeville. A year later, when they purchased the property, the nearest neighbors were hundreds of feet away. Page 137 of our appendix shows a pre-development photograph showing scant development and a vast amount of green space, allowing for natural evaporation, absorption of rainfall in surface waters. 12 years later, in 1989, Wallace Rogers purchased the land adjacent to the Hawkins property. This was developed into a subdivision which is now known as Lorraine Subdivision. It was completed sometime in 1992. Street work was completed in 1993. And previously, the city had adopted the subdivision in 1991, hired an engineer to design and install sewers and streets. The effect is that the streets are now paved, the slope and grade has been changed, and the Hawkings, due to subsequent development in the subdivision over time, now find themselves at the bottom of a vast funnel of water that can neither be evaporated nor absorbed into the soil. And the Hawking property has become a bowl through which water enters but cannot leave because of the raising of the street in front of them. They are essentially the low spot in the entire area. Water can come across numerous lands, jump across the curb of the city street, basically confront the property from going north to south, and pool along the Hawking home in their backyard. Over time, the yard became saturated with water. The waterlogged soil creates hydrostatic pressure on the walls. Water flows into the basement. Then there's mold. The mold is transported up through the house through the furnace system.
Council?
Yes.
Timing is important here in certain respects. I suspect that you're not arguing for D because they really have damages before April of 94. I think, you know, the water rolled downhill and things began to erode, but the mold and the damage probably didn't happen. Is that why you're not arguing for D?
Precisely.
Why aren't you arguing or talking to us about sub 5 at all regarding the statute applying to improvements to real property completed before or on or after April 29, 94?
Because we felt the most applicable were the two sections that we moved forward on with respect to the appeal under our circumstances.
So are you stipulating that this statute of repose does apply and that the only real arguments you have are 4B and 4C? I understand what your arguments are.
Certainly.
But
we are not challenging the time frame issues with respect to the statute of repose.
Okay. Even though it says that the section applies to improvements to real property substantially completed before, on, or after April 29, 1994.
Well, we have a period in 1994 and 1995 at issue. There is substantial completion by 2003, but that is something that we have not argued up to this point.
When was the subdivision complete?
The subdivision was complete in 1992, but there's street work that continued on, and I believe that finished in June of 2003.
Okay. All right. Thank you. I just wondered.
Sure.
Before the project was even completed, Mr. Hawking began to express concern about the grade and likely water problems he would experience to the city and to Lawrence Schmidt, the engineer hired by the city. He was assured that if there was any problem, they would take care of it. From that point on, particularly in 1994 and 1995, going forward, Glenn Hawking would have frequent contact with members of the town council, the city assessor, other city officials. Sometimes visits would occur on the property to show them the damage which is occurring. Sometimes the visits would occur at the city hall. This is repeated. It's happening time and again, particularly as the situation gets worse and worse. Without fail, he is informed that they are coming. Trust us, we're trying to figure something out. He was told not to worry about it, and we are going to fix it.
Council, doesn't the statute require a more formal action by the city council before the ones in your client's position may lawfully rely upon it?
Justice Gableman, we do not believe so. The statute in and of itself, 893.934B, is a plain statute. Under the Kellal case, we read it as it's written. It does not require formal adoption of anything by the city because what we are not trying to do is enforce a promise. The issue here is not about a contract between he and the city. What the issue is that they made a promise which he relied upon, and we think within the purpose of this statute.
How is that different from a contract?
It's different than a contract because all the contract cases cited by the defendant in this case, or appellee, dealt with actual contract issues, dealt with promises for which there's an exchange and consideration, that there was going to be payment, there was going to be all sorts of things. What we have in the statute of repose, Justice Gableman, is really just a initial hurdle with respect to the involvement. And we see that because it talks about express guarantees and promises. It doesn't say written. The statute of frauds is not invoked.
Well, in your view, what would be enough? How many city officials would have to informally represent that action was going to be taken before one may rely on?
Well, under the circumstances, we have most or all of them at one point of time or another visiting. We have the other city officials. We don't have any shortage of city officials.
So what's the rule you're advancing? The classic question is, if you were writing the opinion in this case, what would the rule for future cases be?
I think the rule has to be that there should be some reasonableness on the part of the plaintiff, okay, with respect to the promise. And when he doesn't see things happening relative to that promise, he should go back and see, well, what is the status of this? And that's exactly what we have with Mr. Hawken. I mean, the reasonableness is about on his reliance. I think there should be a reasonableness standard. But in this case, once he is told, Justice Gableman, that there is no hope and we're not going to do anything for you, he responds immediately. A notice of claim is filed under 89380. He contacts the insurance company for the city immediately when he is told. But what we have is, it says a person. Okay, if you read the statute, Your Honor, what we see is if a person makes a warranty, it just takes one under the statute. But under this case, we have lots of them.
Could you sort of outline the positions of the people who were contacted by Mr. Hawken?
The people contacted by Mr. Hawken include members of the Common Council. There was a Leo Klosterman. There was a group of them at least once who all attended, who went to Mr. Hawking's home. There is also the city assessor, basically other city officials, whoever would listen to him, essentially, Your Honor, is
city
what
attorney?
We have here.
City attorney?
In fact, Mr. Glass, the city attorney, was also spoken to by him. But and at no time did they say, well, Mr. Hawken, you need to take some sort of official action. You need to take, we need to get something, some resolution passed.
Is there a mayor in Dodgeville?
There is a mayor in Dodgeville.
Was a mayor involved sometime during the process?
I'm looking at the, in my review of the transcripts of the depositions, I don't know if there's anything in with respect to the mayor personally. So what we have then, and going forward, we have the frequent contact. The city made proposals. The city takes ownership of the problem. It proposes a berm, a wall, a moat, a tube. The first three options would have been a substantial burden on the Hawking property, taking up almost all of the backyard, creating a moat. It's just to deal with the city's water problem.
Mr. Stonebaum, let me ask you this. You touched earlier, I think very early in your presentation, on the streets being raised. Would you explain that to me, please?
If you look, Your Honor, at Exhibit our appendix, page 137, you'll see where the streets are. And in fact, there may be also photographs from different angles. But what essentially happened was that to do the grading on the streets in front of his home, where water would have flowed naturally, had been actually raised. I mean, several feet.
Above his property?
Yes, above the front of his property so that it just would pool. And we have that on the left side and in front, okay? So there's nowhere for this water to go. As the engineer had testified before, it created this bowl effect. And he continues to rely on the city with respect to those issues. He takes action once.
But has the city done anything since there was substantial completion of the streets in 1993? Have they done anything else with those streets?
To our knowledge, no.
The streets were done in 93?
Yes.
Okay, thank you.
But problems, as indicated, what we have is the increase of impervious soil all around with homes being built and all that water being flushed down to the Hawkins and through the streets. And eventually what happens is that problems which were not there even for the city initially create problems for Mr. Hawking as the subdivision develops over a period of years.
Well, I know that you've claimed negligence in regard to maintenance of the streets. Would you explain why you think there's maintenance and negligence tied together here?
Well, maintenance and negligence has to do with the maintenance, in fact, of a nuisance, essentially, Your Honor. What we have is a situation where, if we're going to foresee at this point with respect to that issue, what we have is a maintenance of a nuisance. It becomes a nuisance over time, it gets worse and worse, and then eventually forces the Hawkins out of their home. So we have a scenario where it is maintenance of the issues. The damage is continuing. Nothing is being done by the city to address the changes in the neighborhood causing more water to flow across this area. And so we have a situation where it deals with how these streets are functioning and how they're directing the water directly into the Hawking property.
Council, this is a statutory... I'm sorry, first of all, did you finish your answer to Justice Cook's question?
I
thought you did. That's
I believe so. I apologize if I did miss something.
I apologize.
No problem.
This is a statutory interpretation case, so I want to take a look at the statute. And do you have that in front of you? If not, could you get it? Unless you have it committed to memory.
I regret that I do not have it absolutely committed to memory.
I want to start with 893.89 sub 2.
Okay, I'm there, Your Honor. I'm sorry.
It states, except as provided in sub 3, no cause of action may accrue and no action may be commenced, including an action for contribution or indemnification, against the owner or occupier of property or against any person involved in the improvement to real property. You commenced an action against several folks, but we're here today about the action against the city. In what capacity is the city being sued, as an owner-occupier or as a person?
Your Honor, the city is being sued in more than one capacity here. The city is wearing more than one hat in this case.
Okay, so it looks to me that you can commence an action under sub 2 against an owner or occupier. Are you asserting the city is an owner or occupier here?
It certainly is.
Okay, or against any person involved in the improvement to real property. Are you contending that the city of Dodgeville is a person here?
I hadn't necessarily thought of the city as strictly a person, but I believe that it is a person, and it also has persons who are working for it and on its behalf.
I don't mean to be disrespectful, but you're the one that started the lawsuit.
Exactly.
So you've got to tell me when you filed this lawsuit and when you argued this lawsuit, you indicated that the city, you can commence an action against an owner-occupier, and the city is an owner-occupier. When you filed this lawsuit and when you had this lawsuit in the lower court, did you maintain or did you argue or did you claim that the city was being sued as against any person?
I believe that we did, and with respect to all capacities that it was present and acting.
So if I did an equation, city equals owner occupier, city equals person. You asserted. I didn't look at your complaint, but
sure.
Okay, you're doing both. Is that right?
I believe so.
Okay, now let's get down to 4B. So a person, so you're saying a city who expressly warrants or guarantees the improvement to real estate. I see 4B deals with the person.
Right.
And 4C, which is also the subject of our inquiry today, deals with an owner-occupier. That's why I asked, because there are different meanings here. You can commence against owner-occupier, you can commence against a person. And I'll take a look at the law, the complaint, to see what you did. So if the city is a person, sub B, the city who expresses... Now, are you changing the meaning of person there? What does person mean in 4B? Does that mean the city, as you're suggesting it might mean in 2?
The city, it actually is... A person can be the person making the representations on behalf of the city. It can be the city speaking corporately as a voice in terms of its own actions.
Now, there were some people that were dismissed from this lawsuit. Were those city officials? I forget.
Well, Mr. Schmidt was actually an engineer who was called the city attorney, but actually a city engineer, but he actually was a private contractor. So there was some ambiguity in what he was called, but he was not the city's engineer. There was also Wallace Rogers, who is the other developer with respect to it. Those are people who are obviously at the creation end of this. Mm-hmm. And not on the occupation.
So those were dismissed earlier on in the lawsuit?
They were.
Okay. So so you didn't sue any individuals. You don't have a claim against any individual city officials anymore. Is that right?
That is correct.
So I'm just trying to get a person in 2A means... Since you don't have any individuals, means the city
Yes.
as a corporate entity, you're saying. I pause a little because it didn't sound to me when I first asked the question that you were doing that. But that's what you've been doing, saying that if your cause of action against the city as a person as opposed to an owner-occupier.
Correct. I mean, the statute, of course, is not limited to the municipal setting. It's limited to any of those individuals involved in the creation.
Yeah, but we just have a municipality here. That's
exactly.
The
so they would fit whatever space they fit in.
Okay. So under 4B, then, if a person is a person, you're saying is either the city or an individual.
The city or an individual who has apparent authority to speak for the city or a member. We're using it more broadly with respect to, because those are the people actually making the representations to the Hawkins as lay people.
Well, counsel, doesn't that beg the question of who has the authority to bind the city? And I'd like you to address, if you would please, the Holzbauer decision. And how your position, your client's position on that authority is either consistent or inconsistent with that case.
Our position with respect to Holzbauer, Your Honor, is that it is a pure contract case. This is not about binding the city. This is about whether there was a representation that someone might rely upon to their detriment so that they wouldn't file in time within 10 years. And in this case, there's a plethora of those representations. Holzbauer is inapposite to this case. This didn't involve the enforcement of a promise. This case is not a breach of contract case with the city. It is a tort case. This case is not about a promise broken with respect to a contract. It's about a promise with respect to damages. Every case involving Chapter 62 that we have come across, or we have analyzed, or cited by the defendants, involved a strict breach of contract, not a damage situation.
So in your view, Holzbauer is limited to the situation of a contract for consideration and has no relationship to who has authority to bind the city.
Exactly. This is not about binding the city. This is about, did representatives of the city, did they reasonably rely upon it to a guarantee or a promise, essentially? And when you look at the definition of guarantee or warranty, it's a pledge. We're going to deal with your situation, and I relied upon it. The only issue that we are here about today is about them stringing the Hawkins along, essentially, until they had no more time, and then saying, too bad, so sad, you didn't follow an exact framework for
that. So what you're advocating is a correct me if I'm wrong, but it seems to me what you're advocating is a totality of the circumstances analysis as to whether a reasonable person under the same or similar circumstances could have reasonably relied upon the representation of city employees.
I think that that is largely in the main fair, but ultimately it is fair, but if we go back to the language of the statute here, of 4B, we have a situation where is there a guarantee or a warranty by a person with respect to that improvement? And here there is. You won't have problems. If you do, we'll deal with them. And there is definitely a reliance issue, but it's not an equitable estoppel argument. In fact, it's been provided by the legislature. It's a statutory estoppel issue. This is not about a contract between he and the city. It's about, can he meet the first hurdle with respect to what's your reason why you didn't file within 10 years? Because I was given a promise that they are going to deal with this, and I kept that. I kept believing that promise till they told me I couldn't believe them anymore, and then I took action. This is not a laches case.
Counselor, you know, your language is a little confusing to me, because to me, promise language is contract language. But then you talk about stringing your clients along, which to me sounds like misrepresentation, which sounds like a tort. And, you know, you have to be a fish or you have to be a fowl, and I'm a little confused about what you're asking us to address. Are you asking us to address a misrepresentation by the city that they were going to fix this, and then they didn't, and the statute of limitations now they're raising against it? Or are you saying they promised to fix it, so I took forbearance from proceeding against them, and once they withdrew their promise, I tried to proceed? I mean, what are you telling us?
I'm saying what this truly is. It's a platypus, Your Honor. It has both aspects of misrepresentation. It meets all the tests for both. And when we're talking about, we're not suing on the promise, once again, we're suing on the nuisance. The issue is, why should the statute of repose not apply? The statute of repose will not apply when there's a promise. But it's not about the facts of the promise or the enforceability of the promise, other than did they induce reliance? Did they do something which we don't countenance in Wisconsin? We are better than this as a state. To have our municipalities do what happened here without question and without dispute.
Yeah, but B says expressly warrants or guarantees the improvement of real property. And there are in real estate transactions guarantees and warranties, and they usually have a limited time period, maybe short, maybe long. And then it says for the period of that warranty or guarantee. So what was the period of that the city expressly warrants or guarantees, and what was the improvement to the real property that was expressly warranted or guaranteed?
Well, I see that my time out. May I continue?
Answer, yes.
With respect to the promise, or what is being expressly warranted or guaranteed? Number one, that they would address the issue, that they would stop the water, they would fix the problem. The time period of that would be that they were going to do it as soon as they could. They were going to address it as well as they could, as soon as they could. They didn't give him an outer time limit until they did, and that's what happened.
And what was the improvement to the property? Was that the streets? What was the you have to warrant or guarantee the improvement to real property.
Right.
What was the improvement to real property?
The improvement extended beyond the subdivision. I mean, the improvement was the subdivision itself, which included.
Well, the city didn't build the houses.
Agreed. But the city.
City didn't build the streets, did they? They just took them over.
Well, the city actually hired the engineer to do the work.
No. But who did the engineer work for?
The city. He was being hired by the city at that point in time.
So the city built the streets? Is that your position? Under this plan?
I know with respect to the engineering, they were paying for it. With respect to the individual contractors, I don't have that for you.
All right.
But with respect to what is being warranted and guaranteed. I think that a claim could be made that the city was warranting and guaranteeing the streets, the parts that they were taking ownership of. However, in this case, one may not have a duty until one assumes a duty. And here, the city was going to deal with the water problems regardless of its point of origin if it had something to do with that improvement, which was the subdivision. Meaning that what the city was essentially telling the Hawkings is, we are going to solve the problem, not just relative to the street, but through any means that this water is coming to you. So they actually, the people who were making these representations that the Hawkings were relying on, were not just limiting the scope of those representations to whatever contribution was from the street. That was a very broad situation. And what the effect of that was, Justice Abramson, is that essentially that acted to shield every other potential liable person here. Because the city is saying, we're going to deal with it, we'll handle it, and we'll fix it. So therefore, the 10 years passed not just with respect to the city, it went with respect to Mr. Rogers, and it went with respect to Mr. Schmidt's work.
The named individuals are not city employees, are they?
No. The named individuals.
They were all property owners?
They were the uphill property owners, as we discussed before.
You have 5 minutes.
May I ask,
Justice Prosser.
Why didn't the Hawkings sue before the 10 years ran up?
The Hawkings didn't sue before the 10 years ran up because they believed their city. They believed the individuals that when they went to the city offices, they believed the individuals who came to their home. And until the city told them, we are not going to do anything for you, contact our insurance company, that is when the Hawkings said, we need to do something, because they are not going to fulfill what they said they were. And so they are essentially strung along. I mean, if you look at the timing of when the streets were finished, that was June of 2003. They are told, we are not going to be helping you at all in September of 2003. It's just very quickly after the 10-year period went beyond that.
Should we hold it against the Hawkings that they believed the city? I mean, 10 years, how long can you go on believing a city that doesn't do anything for you?
Well, it's not merely the provision of saying, well, we'll get around to it and we'll take care of it. The city was actually working on this. I mean, they had people who were proposing various walls and berms and things of that nature. And they're trying to work through something that didn't make the subservient property here, the Hawkings whole backyard, be just a receptacle point for the city. Finally, they agreed on something. They agreed that this tube was going to be the solution. Mr. and Mrs. Hawking agreed with that. And the city, according to Mr. Hawking, lost the tube. Based on what he was told, they don't have it. They don't know where it went. So I guess we're not going to help you. It's bizarre. But ultimately, I don't think you can hold it against the Hawkings, because there's no latches here. They didn't sit on their rights. Once they're told by an individual from the city assessor, we're not going to be able to help you, they acted very quickly. And they would have acted quickly if they hadn't been strung along. I mean, I think what we see here is that if you're not going to be keeping your promise, then I guess I'm going to have to do something. But they're not lawyers.
Thank you, Mrs. Stonebaugh. You have 5 minutes of rebuttal. Ms. Van Horn, representing the city of Dodgeville.
May it please the court and counsel, my name is Peggy Van Horn and I'm representing the city of Dodgeville. First of all, I want to address a couple things, I think factually wise, that Mr. Stonebaugh, I don't think was made clear. Is first of all, the substantial completion of the roads was in 1993. There was some reference throughout this that's of 2003. That's simply not the case. All of the facts in the case, including the affidavits of Mr. Schmidt, who did the work, Mr. Rogers, who was the developer, and also the testimony of Mr. Hawking. It's undisputed that substantial completion of the street project and the subdivision in its total was it was actually substantially completed in 1992, and then a final top layer of asphalt was put in the, I think it was the June of 1993. So the improvement that we're talking about here was substantially completed in 1992 and certainly by 1993. Also, in the Hocking's briefs, they have conceded that the statute of limitations, the 10 years, does apply, but their argument is that two of the exceptions that we've been talking about, sub B and 4B and 4C, are exceptions to the statute of repose.
Do you agree with that?
That 4B,
that in fact all of subsection 4, survives this statute of repose?
I don't believe that the exceptions do apply. I believe that the city is entitled to that the trial court and court of appeals properly dismissed the complaint for the plaintiff's failure to file their action within the 10 years post substantial completion.
Well, what does sub 5 mean? Except as provided in sub 4, this section applies to improvements to real property substantially completed before, on, or after April 1994.
I believe that that's saying that Section 8, the statute of repose, the 10-year period, applies to improvements to real property regardless of the date that those improvements took place, because it says before, on, or after April of 1994. I assume that the purpose of this particular provision was to make it clear that although the statute was coming into effect in 1994, that it was actually going to be applied to improvements that were actually developed, you know, before the time of the statute, as well as improvements that were being developed after the time of the statute.
Did city officials make any promises to the Hockings about remediating the problem?
According to Mr. Hockings, this was a summary judgment case, so for purposes of summary judgment, we have to rely on what the plaintiffs are saying, because otherwise there would be disputed issues of fact. So according to Mr. Hocking, various people, city council members, you know, individually would come out and did tell him on occasion that the city should, you know, would be able to try to help him with this problem out there.
Try to help? I mean, did any of them represent that they would help?
Mr. Hocking did testify that city council members told him that they would assist him in remedying the problem.
That if there was a problem, they would take care of it, I think, was his deposition testimony in the affidavit.
That's what Mr. Hocking said, correct.
Was there a problem?
According to Mr. Hocking, there was.
Well, I mean, you don't acknowledge that there was a problem?
I don't acknowledge, and I think it's kind of going a little beyond what the argument here. I acknowledge that Mr. Hocking had water on his property and that there was water getting into his basement. I do not acknowledge that the cause of this water was the development of the subdivision and certainly not the development of the streets.
What was the cause?
The topography of this land. And we had some expert reports that were filed as, you know, originally, but showed that there was actually post-development, there was actually less water entering Mr. Hocking's property than prior to the development. That's the city's position. I don't know that the merits of that is part of what the issues are that we're talking about.
If there was less water entering Mr. Hocking's property after the development, why would city officials say they'd take care of the problem?
This was a small community, and as Mr. Schmidt testified in his deposition, if someone called somebody from the city, the street and roads people out to their property, and they had a problem, it was a small community. If the city could, you know, they might try to help people.
Why did they decide not to help them? I mean, people came back and forth and back and forth. What was the big change? Why did they decide, hey, we're just not going to help you, you're stuck? I don't.
There was never a decision, and I guess that kind of does get us to the point here. There was never a decision, yes, we're going to help him, or no, we're not going to help him. There were people that would go out and suggest, oh, you could try this, you could try that. And it went on, and Mr. Hocking would be going to, you know, to the assessor. He would go to the city clerk. He'd go to anybody and say, what are you going to do to correct my problem? And some people threw out, you know, suggestions on what somebody could do. I don't believe that there's anything that there was any agreed upon proposal by the city. And that gets me to the issue, which I think is primary under 4B, is that I do believe that the statute requires, because this is a municipality, a formal vote by the city council. And there was not a vote by the city council to do something, and there wasn't a vote by the city council not to do something. One of the arguments that the plaintiff raises is that by requiring the municipal formal action under the 4B exception, that it somehow is creating a formality that does not exist, and I disagree strongly with that, because the requirements of common council, a majority or two-thirds of vote of a common council, that in Chapter 62, that's been around forever, and the language of Chapter 62 is very specific, that it actually takes express language to remove the formal requirements of the voting process of the Common Council. And when we look at the 4B exception, there's no express language that would remove the requirement of a formal response. And
so I understand your argument well in regard to contract law. And me, warranties, guarantees are contract law. What I have a concern about is kind of the mixture of what's been argued by plaintiff's counsel, and it sounds a little bit to me like misrepresentation, which would fall under 4A, which of course none of you folks have briefed for us or argued to us. But what he's saying is, you told me you'd fix it, and you're not. Would it take a formal action of the Common Council, in your opinion, to make a misrepresentation to someone? Or could that be done by an individual employee of the city?
I think it would have to be the Common Council as a whole. I don't believe that an individual Common Council member that goes out and makes representations to a constituent is going to be binding on that municipality. And I think that if we were to have that as a rule of law, it would be very problematic, because in municipalities there's strong divisions between individuals on Common Councils, and one person might believe this and be, you know, saying something, but, you know, to make those representations binding on a municipality could have kind of catastrophic results for the municipalities throughout the state.
Well, A says commits fraud, concealment, or misrepresentation, not generally, but related to a deficiency or defect. So if they said they were going to repair it and didn't, is that a misrepresentation relating to a deficiency or defect in the improvement? They're agreeing there's a deficiency or defect if they say they're going to improve it, they're going to repair it.
I don't think by a person's representation that we're going to try to fix your problem is a misrepresentation that the improvement was defective in this setting. I think it was a Common Council person coming out and talking to their constituents and seeing a problem, and regardless of cause, wanting to help that person. I don't see it as a Common Council, a municipal misrepresentation to an individual.
Ms. Van Horn, let me ask you, if I might, about 4C. As I understood the argument of opposing counsel, it was basically that what was going on here was the city was maintaining a nuisance, and that this was a continuing nuisance. How do you respond to that argument?
The statute protects improvements to real property that involve the design and construction. And in this case, the only criticism of the streets made by their amended complaint and by their expert witness relates to the construction and design of the subdivision and of the streets. So the fact that the city hasn't changed the design or changed the construction doesn't mean that there's a failure in the maintenance of the streets. There's the Kahn versus the School District of Darlington case, and I think in that case they talk about really the difference between the responsibility of an owner or an occupier to keep up the improvement. So, for example, if in this case the water was excess water went on to Mr. Hocking's because the city didn't clear the gutters and we had it filled up with leaves over and over and the water as a result piled onto Mr. Hocking's property. In that case, I think we would have a maintenance issue that would be an exception to the statute of repose. But in our case, what we have here is all of the criticisms go back to the original design and construction of the subdivision. And there's no allegation in the complaint, and there's no evidence by anybody that anything that the city did post-construction is what contributed to the water on Mr. Hocking's property, that it was the original design, and it was, according to the plaintiff's expert, the original design and the original construction that caused the water problem in the first place.
When did Mr. Hocking build this house? When was this house
built? I think he moved there, I believe Mr. Stombaugh said, in the late 70s.
But there's less water on his property now than there was in the late 70s?
According to the studies, that it shows that there's actually less because of the way the streets actually are diverting the water down the street. If you look on the plat, Roelli, it goes down the center, so it takes the water down the center. In the past, the properties on the east side of Roelli would flow across the streets and across, Mr. Hocking's property, but also across the northern properties to the north of Mr. Hocking. But the streets is actually diverting some of that water because it goes down the streets. From a merit standpoint, that's what our position is.
What's the strongest equitable argument that the city has in this case?
I believe we have a situation here where there were suggestions. Mr. Hocking has not done anything, nothing, to try to reduce the flow of water to his foundation. Mr. Hocking's expert witness in the injunction hearing talked about the fact that even if they would have put sandbags down, that would have corrected the problem. So it wasn't, the correction here could be something complicated and involved like a stormwater sewer system, but a temporary solution that Mr. Hocking could have done to help minimize some of his own problems was put some sandbags down, take some action of his own to temporarily deal with these issues until the city, while he was waiting for the city to do something. Then when the city did nothing, there would not have been the years of ongoing water intrusion. I think from an equitable standpoint, I think that Mr. Hocking's reliance on the city is I don't think it was reasonable reliance. I think at some point, as Mr. Hocking in his deposition said, he would have he was always, you know, going and talking to people. He'd talk to somebody at the restaurant over coffee. And yet nothing was being done. And I think that 10 years is an adequate amount of time that, you know, certainly after 2 years, after some other amount of time, he should have sought some other.
As Mr. Stombach mentioned, forgotten whether it was a pipe or a tube or something, but what was that all about?
According to Mr. Hocking, there was some proposal of some sort of pipe to be put, I believe, between Mr. Hocking's property and the property immediately to the north. I call it the O'Rourke property. That was the most recent owner of the property. That's what, again, it was not any formal. There was no engineering budgets. There were no engineering designs. There was no true discussion about how this would this work. Would it was about how it would work, nor any approval from anyone from the city for that particular project. To my knowledge, it was one of many ideas that were thrown out by people looking at his property.
What about estoppel? I know it's not listed under 4A, B, C, or D, but if you've got reliance on a promise, doesn't the city keep the word of the employee? Can't we rely on anybody in government?
I think a statute of repose, by its nature, is not particularly equitable. The idea of a statute of repose is to cut off rights after a certain amount of time. And I think that in this case, the equitable considerations don't impact whether the statute of repose applies. And that's a policy decision, I believe, that was made when the statute of repose is put into place. And when it comes to this, to dealings with the cities, as noted in a couple of the cases, in the Hasbauer case, and I think the Gonzalez case talked about it as well, it's difficult to deal with the municipality, and you take some risk when you do so. And as a property owner, as anybody dealing with the municipality, it's sort of up to each person who deals with the municipality to deal with them in a way that a legally appropriate manner. And in this case, the Hockings needed to get a formal approval by the Common Council. And is that somewhat of a harsh result? It may be, but statutes of repose by their nature are somewhat harsh as a matter of public policy.
I'm trying to think of the city doing something, and we don't need a city council meeting, and we don't need a resolution, and we don't need it passed. So if I call the city and say, hey, there's a tree on the land next to my home, and that land is owned by the city, and there is a tree on it, and it is dead, and it should be cut down before it falls on my house or the next door neighbor house or on some child that's in that area. We don't need a resolution. And the city tree man says, we'll be out there as soon as we can. 1 year passes, 2 years pass. I mean, I don't need a resolution from the city, do I? The guy says he's going to come.
I don't think you don't need a resolution to call the city and have them come out, and the city may well come out. And you know, that gets, I think, it's more of a, if that tree falls over between the time you call and between the time they come
out. Okay, let's have the tree fall right on my house. Extensive damage.
Right, I think then.
Is it liable?
Yeah. Because then we're sort of into the discretionary immunity standpoint, and we have a known and present danger, which is this dead tree. I think the municipality maybe, but that would be under
a different
statute, not under the statute of repose that specifically talks about the improvements to real property. And then when it talks about guarantees, it talks about an express guarantee or warranty for the period of the warranty. I mean, it's that statute is really trying to focus on something more than just a comment by even a number of people. It's really looking for something, and I believe, formal, an express warranty.
I hear two things. One, look at the statute. It says express warrant or guarantee. That sounds contractual, very formal. Therefore, you're going to need something formal from the city.
Yeah, I would agree.
The other thing is, I don't think the city can take the position that any time the city makes a promise to somebody to do something, that you need a city council resolution. So what I want to know is, what's the dividing line, if we can find one, between when do I need a city council and when can I trust the person on the phone who says they're going to remove the tree from my property or they're going to do something else?
I think I'm going to refer to Chapter 62 because I think, and I don't remember exactly what section I want to talk about, but where it talks about, I think it's 62, where it talks about the powers of the Common Council, and as I recall,
6211 sub 5, maybe.
Yep, that's it. When it comes to, you know, it says the council should have management and control of property, finances, highways, you know, public service. When it comes to some an issue that requires the expenditure of city funds, I think at that point you do need to you have to have common council. If it's one of the powers enunciated in the statute in 6211, then I think you have to have the common council. So I believe something like we were talking about cutting the limb off of a tree, although it takes personnel because you have a, you know, right, your arborer who's going to go out there and chop it down, I don't think it rises to the
they standard. Even have to rent special equipment for this tree.
Right.
Sounds like it's in the ordinary course of business, whereas maybe preventing flooding is not in the ordinary course of business and may be more expensive. I don't know. That's what I'm asking you.
And that certainly is a distinction, and I don't, as I don't have a concrete answer to say, you know, if you cross this line, it's, you know, if it costs $200, then you need approval, and if it's less than $200, it's not. I think that if it is something that the person making the promise doesn't have the authority to give, then it needs the Common Council approval. And I think when we talk about Common Council individuals going to Mr. Hocking's property, they don't have the authority by their voice to commit the city as a whole. An arborer who goes out and cuts the tree he can go and he takes the stuff, he cuts down the tree, cuts down the limb. I think there's a difference between the authority level of the person making the representation.
Any other questions?
Yeah, my time is up.
You have a few minutes if you want to sum.
I guess the last thing I would like to talk about is two sort of general public policy issues. The first of all is one of the purposes of the statute of limitations is to sort of cut off the long tail of some claims. And in this case, it's now, you know, 2010. We're almost 20 years post the time of construction. We're 10-plus years past the time that many of the representations that Mr. Hocking claims to have occurred have happened. As Mr. Hocking testified, he doesn't know the names of some of the people he talked to from the city. Some of those people have died. From a defense, it's very difficult now, 20 years down the line, to try to refute some of the allegations being made by Mr. Hocking, and I think that that's went into the consideration of the 10-year statute of repose. And then lastly, again, just to mention quickly the fact of the potential impact on municipalities that finding that a individual common council member's representations to an individual on a financial matter, how the adverse financial problems that could cause to municipalities, particularly when we have common council boards who often strongly disagree with each other and are also elected officials that may make representations on their own to satisfy somebody, to get somebody to stop calling them all the time. To have those be actually binding on the municipality would certainly be a financial problem for just about every municipality in the state. Thank you.
Thank you, Council. Mrs. Stomba, you have 5 minutes in rebuttal.
I would like to thank Ms. Van Horn for correcting my when I misspoke about 2003 versus 1993. Clearly that was in our briefing as well. But there are several things that she brought up that just aren't in the record. Number one, studies in the record about less water going onto the property. That's not in the record in this case with respect to this appeal. If they had disputed the facts, they should have filed affidavits doing so. They did not.
They file affidavits. I have before me an affidavit of the engineer that was sued here that said he made no statements. Someplace I have it. That he made no statements regarding this as asserted. That's Lawrence Schmidt.
Lawrence Schmidt was the other defendant in the case, but she was citing, Your Honor, from his deposition, and I don't know that is part of the record.
I just heard you say that they should have filed something to contest it.
Essentially,
his averment number 22, I made no assurances or representations written or oral to the plaintiff that action would be taken to ameliorate any damage that they alleged occurred. I'm not saying it's true or not true.
Oh, sure.
I'm just saying that there are affidavits contrary to that have been filed.
With respect to the defense of the appeal, though, Mr. Hawking's statements have been largely unrefuted with respect to what he said. And it wasn't just that they were going to help him. I'm quoting page 9 of our brief, which is the appendix 147-148. Not to worry about it. We're going to take care of it. We're going to fix it. And what were they telling you they were going to fix? They were going to stop the water problem on my land. Now, Mr. Hocking has testified in his deposition that he never had water in his basement before these changes. I mean, with respect to there being less water on that property, I don't think the physical facts bear that out. With respect to this is not just a situation where we have the reaction of an individual council member. They had Mr. Bisbach, I believe, they had city engineers working on the solution. They were paying their engineers to try to come up with solutions with respect to this issue. I see that my time is up. Thank you.
May I ask, do city council records indicate that the Hocking property problem was ever discussed?
I have seen no city council minutes with respect to the Hocking issue. Neither were at any point do they have evidence in this case that the Hawkings were told that they needed to do anything formal. After all, they had the council members there on several occasions. They had, the city had engineers working on it. What sort of apparent authority or apparent action is being taken place? It appeared as though he was getting everything he needed from the city up until the very end when they told him, we're not going to be able to help you. So, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Stomper. Thank you, Ms. Van Horn, for your arguments. We've had a number of water problem cases in the last couple of years. This one raises yet a different issue. This concludes our hearing in 08 AP 2012, Hawking versus City of Dodgeville. It's about 5 or 4 of 11. The court will reconvene after the fire alarm completes its sound. So we are in recess until about a couple of minutes after 11.